Well, of course, like most people who ended up in pirate radio, I was a fan to begin with. And I was a fan of the offshore stations around the UK in the 1960s and early 1970s. In 1976, I packed my bags and went off to Israel to work for the Voice of Peace, where I stayed for it was getting on for a year. It wasn't quite a year. Then back in the UK, I was with Caroline through 78 to until the ship sank in early 1980. I was then at Sunshine Radio in Dublin.
Did you come from Caroline to Sunshine?
Well, there was a bit of a gap because the ship sank in the March of 1980, and I arrived in Dublin at the behest of Stevie Gordon, or Stevie Dunn as he was known in Ireland, in February of 1981. And I stayed with Sunshine until the end of 1980. I think it was November 83. November 82. My apologies. And went, then Andy Archer asked me to go across to Nova, where I stayed until it all fell apart in the early 1984, essentially.
Were you in Nova for the raids and for the jamming in that period?
Yes, I was the person that answered the door to the P&T when they came to close us down in that fateful day in May of 1983.
What did you do?
First of all, I went down to the studio and told Declan Meehan just to keep going. I would not be appearing at 10 o'clock, which was our usual slot. So Declan stayed on the air. And he started putting out messages asking Chris Carey to come to Herbert Street. I'm sure you've heard all the recordings of those. In the meantime, the P&T people wanted me to switch it off, which I refused to do. And they said, well, we're going up to the transmitter site now. So I said, well, I better come with you. So I took a lift with the P&T official up to Rathfarnham, to the AM site. And the rest of the rest of that day is a bit of a blur, to be honest. I did spend the 40 minutes or so it took to drive up to Rathfarnham needling the P&T guy about what he was going to tell his wife when he got home that day. I think they kept saying, how are you going to explain to your wife that you've just turned off her favourite radio station? So he wasn't particularly pleased with that needling, but it went on for most of the journey. That night, once the raid had taken place and had been completed and trucks had arrived to take away huge transmitters and so on and so forth, Chris Carey took us all out to the Mirabeau restaurant, if I remember, took the entire station out and... I think we got thoroughly drunk, thoroughly feasted, and even at that point it was... Oh, sorry, that it would have been after the close-down day. Sorry, that happened. But even at that point, there were plans to put the whole thing back on again. It was, right, we'll give it a few days, then we'll try to work out how to get this thing back on.
And when you said that things started to fall apart at the beginning of 1984, are you talking about the dispute with the NUJ, or was it some other aspect that you were referring to?
Well, there was the... The strike was probably a mistake, and I was involved in that. It was probably a mistake. But it had really arrived because of RTE's jamming. The jamming that was carried out by RTE engineers and assisted by BBC engineers from the north, which is not widely known, but as long as I'm not naming anybody, that's not defamation, is it? But it was. They borrowed kit from the BBC to help them achieve this.
Is it true that the jamming came from the site of the RTE Museum in Rathmines? That was what was reported at the time.
I think it probably was, but I couldn't be 100% sure. So the jamming caused it caused all sorts of problems. And we ended up with a situation where Chris decided to close down KISS, the sister station. And essentially, there were too many people. And because the future looked so rocky with all the jamming, I guess he wanted to cut costs down to the absolute minimum. And that's why people were fired. And the union said, hang on, you can't do that. And the NUJ kind of steamed in and made a fuss. And so there was, there was a picket line, and it was all extremely messy. I don't really blame the NUJ, but I do blame RTE. So, you know, if they hadn't jammed the station, people wouldn't have been fired. There wouldn't have been a strike. You know, take it from there. But it was a mistake. We shouldn't have gone on strike.
So when you left Nova then at the beginning of 1984, where did you end up after that?
I went across to the UK. I got a gig with the Chiltern Radio Network in Bedfordshire, which ended up being a three-station network, and I stayed there until the end of 1987.
So you came back then to Ireland to Kiss FM in Monaghan.
Yes.
So that was a huge operation with an enormous, powerful signal beaming into the north. Can you tell us about what exactly you were doing there, what your involvement in Kiss FM was?
Presenter, programme director, essentially. Station manager. It's a huge operation, you called it. It was only a very small core of people. Essentially, you know, a team of presenters, a couple of newsreaders, technician.
A huge, I suppose I meant the power was pretty outstanding. And, you know, you were aiming very, very clearly into the northern market, which was not very well served at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's the... I think most people have seen the TV programme the BBC did, which features... I think it's Roisin Duffy was the reporter. Yeah. Sitting in a park in Belfast, tuning the stations, and there's Kiss louder than just about anything on the dial. Yeah, it was powerful in that sense. It wasn't a huge transmitter. It was a 10-kilowatt transmitter, but because of the antenna array and the way where it was sited, it was much more powerful than the output than the 10 kilowatts going into it. So Miles, of course, will give you the exact... Well, he refers to it as megawatts, but...
This was Miles Johnson, the engineer. Yeah. So why do you think did Kiss FM go on the air? Because you knew when you started that you'd only have a few months. It was the spring of 1988 and the close downs were on the cards for the 31st of December. Would it have been possible to make any money in that time?
Listen, I can't tell you whether it made money. The guys got... We got, as a staff, we got paid, which is great. I don't know. It wasn't my radio station. I didn't own it. Obviously, the investors thought that either the whole close down thing would be put off or not happen at all. I suppose it was a risk they were prepared to take. I think the bulk of the investment was probably the transmission side. The studios were okay, but they wouldn't have been that expensive in the grand scheme of things.
And can you tell us about your memories of the close down then? Because you were on air on the 31st of December 1988. Tell us about the build up to that and so on.
Well, we'd been running for a couple of weeks a kind of fairly low key campaign on air, which basically said something like, from the 31st of December, your favourite radio station will have a new sound, and it would be the sound of a hiss or silence or something like that. But we didn't really get stuck into that whole close down thing until the last couple of days. You know, Nick Richards and his cat on the morning. Then we were supposed to stick to a fairly regular schedule, but the idea was to get as many of the presenters on the air during that last day. And I said I would look after the last bit. So I think I went on the air at about 5 o'clock. Dennis Murray was actually on the air before me. Dennis is here today.
Yes, I spoke to Dennis earlier.
So, it was emotional. And we stoked up the emotion, of course. You do. It's, you know, the best close down was probably Tony Allen's Nova in 83 at the... So, you know, we owed a little bit to that close down as well, a similar kind of approach. But I think we really thought that might be a last-minute reprieve. We thought that licensing in the new year would be more liberal, and none of those things came true. It was a sad day, but boy, we had a party. We had a great party afterwards. So.
And did Kiss get involved in an application for a licence in Monaghan in the border counties?
It did. I had nothing to do with it. Miles Johnson would know more about that. By that time, I'd I stuck around in Monaghan for a week or so after the event, to just early in the new year, and it was clear nothing more was going to happen. So I just got back on the ferry, I'm afraid. So.
And can I ask you what you think the Pirates contributed? You were involved in several of them over a decade in Ireland. What do you think they contributed to Irish life?
Now, Bob Geldof once said that the 1970s in Dublin were like the 1950s in Britain. Whether he was right or not, it's not for me to comment. I wasn't here. But I think it was probably a stimulus and indeed a reaction to changing times in Ireland. The UK had its commercial radio since 73, yet at the time, pretty conservative Irish establishment had not even really considered it, and it was RTE, and there was a token, and then Pirates were springing up through the 70s. So I think it was that change of social attitudes during the 1970s and early 1980s. As I say, pirate radio was both a symptom and a stimulus. So I think that's perhaps a contribution that's overlooked. It did set a blueprint, I think, for how pop radio sounded for many years. And there were, when things were legalized, suddenly you're having to work with 20% news and current affairs and record royalty payments and all sorts of complex things, which were not part of the pirate scene. So, but nevertheless, the early, if you look at Capital Radio, what is now FM 104, that didn't sound so different to Q102 that had gone before. A lot of the same voices. Same attitude. I think some of the mistakes that the Capital made in the early days, and I know Martin Block and all those guys, is that they still thought that there was 18 radio stations on in the city. So when they weren't, they were the only game in town. Well, there's themselves and Century maybe and 2FM, but Millennium I think would have been finished the year before.
I think they kept Millennium going a few months to fill some of the gap in early 1989 when there was literally nobody else on the air.
But it changed things. It changed me. It changed. Some of the 80s music was god awful when we look back at it. Jesus. I suppose I'd come from Caroline, and I like the stuff that Caroline's second golden age was, in actual fact, the sort of kind of late 70s, an album stroke rock format. And that's the type of music I, at the time, liked. And, then I'm in Dublin playing pop music. And, I suppose it was a case of, some of the music was great. But a lot of it was bloody awful. I'm sorry, folks. For those of you who really enjoyed the 80s Pirates, that's just a personal thing.